minutes, 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. This is Grant Cameron, and I'm joined by my assistant in Illinois, Nicole Sakic. How are you doing, Nicole?
I'm doing well, Grant. Hi.
Beautiful. And we have a special guest tonight. We have Les Velez, who I saw your interview with Terry Lovelace. And Nicole and I interviewed Terry, and I was just really amazed at the stuff you're doing. Because you got a background, Bachelor of Science, and you've spent many years with the MUFON organization with different things that you were doing, like training coordinator and field investigator and state director of Northern California and all this kind of stuff. The thing I'm most interested in when I saw your interview with Terry Lovelace is that Les has done a lot of work with whatever you want to call them, experiencers, contactees, and I firmly maintain that until we talk to these people, we are never going to solve the UFO dilemma. You can look at all the lights in the sky you want. It's not really going to solve anything except to tell you that something's going on. I maintain with the metal, you can gather all the metal you want and look at it. It's going to be very anomalous, weird isotopes, all this kind of stuff. And it's going to say, yeah, we probably didn't make it, but that's as far as you get with it. It's not until you talk to the people who are interacting with the intelligence that's behind the UFO phenomena that you're going to figure out what you have any chance of figuring out what's going on. You may never figure it out, but you have a chance. So Les Velez is joining us from Texas today. How you doing, Les?
Good, good. Grant, thank you very much. And Nicole, thank you for having me on tonight.
Yeah, and I, as I said, I'm very interested in your research you're doing. You have your organization. I'll get you to describe your organization in a minute. But let's go back to the origin story, because I just heard this a couple of days ago, your origin story, your initial sighting. So let's go through that, how you get involved and what year that was, because I think you go back maybe as far as I do, and you have the same sort of origin story as me, that I saw a UFO. I didn't intend to see a UFO. I saw it. The rest of my friends went on with their life, and I fell off the edge of the earth, and I never got out of the rabbit hole. So let's go to your origin story and describe, how did you get into the UFO phenomenon? And maybe add on to that, do you think that this is random? Do you think that, because you know the phenomena that once somebody sees something, they sort of get wrapped up in it, and it seems to take over their life, and they seem to work on certain programs and things that give them sort of meaning. So let's go to your origin story. And what do you think it actually means in terms of why you saw it? Do you believe it's a random event, or do you think it has some meaning?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it was 1958. So there you go. that's way back.
And you're what, 11 years old then?
Yeah, exactly. And so I was out, it was a late October evening, and I was coming back in the house. And as I looked off to my right, I saw this white ovalish object, totally silent, hovering over the tree line, slowly moving off into an area behind my house and into an area where there's another street. Well, it just scared the hell out of me. And I ran in the house and I tried to get my father to come out. But by the time I finally convinced him to come out, it was gone. And he told me, he says, well, it's probably just a beacon of light reflecting off a cloud. Well, that didn't sit with me very well. And soon after that, I went to the library and looked up some books on UFOs. And back in those days, George Adamski was the top of the hit parade, so to speak, and with the UFOs. And so, you know, I immersed myself in this thing, and I was reading everything I could possibly get my hands on. And then it's like somebody threw a switch. I became an adolescent, and I guess girls became a little bit more important in my life, and, you know, went off to college and served in the military, in the Army artillery as an officer. And I came back after that and went to work for Procter & Gamble in their health and beauty aid section. Anyway, in 1985, okay, I moved out to California, into San Jose, California. And I picked up the San Jose Mercury News one day, and Stanton Freeman was going to be talking about UFOs and the government cover-up. And it was like the switch got turned on again. And I said, okay, I got to go see this guy. And so I went to San Jose City College, where he was going to speak. And he gave, you know, one of his inimitable, you know, lectures about the government and showing redacted information, you know, in these books and everything, documentation. And MUFON had a table in the foyer. And so I decided I was going to get the MUFON journal. Well, that was something that satisfied me for a while, but then I said, I got to get more involved. And I subsequently became a field investigator. And the cases that I got involved with, almost without exception, turned out to be abduction type cases. First, the people saw the object, and then shortly thereafter, there was missing time. And then subsequent to that, after they had either conscious recall of the situation, or with help from a therapist, they discovered the fact that they had been taken and brought on board a craft. And so these people, you know, asked me, did I know of other people having similar circumstances in their lives? And I said, yes, I do. And the next thing I'm doing is I'm facilitating a support group in San Jose. Well, I tell you what, I never learned as much from any book that I ever picked up by listening to these people. I mean, I learned so much just listening to these people tell their stories. And one of these cases that I got involved with, which I think you're going to be very interested in as well, because this couple were in a park near Santa Cruz, California, and they saw this light over the ocean, and this was near dusk. And this object, the light got bigger and bigger until it was literally over their head, and it was the size of a Learjet, but it was the shape of a triangle, okay? Uh-huh. And this happened six more times. Total of seven craft came in of that size and went into a canyon behind them. And then they were just sitting there horizontally, you know, kind of doing that butterfly thing. And the whole group then went up on its side vertically. And it's like they went around a corner and just totally disappeared.
And are these like black triangles with the lights, or what was the? Did they give
no,
you
they were they were a silvery, a gray silvery kind of color, and they had white and red lights on the corners, white on the bottom, red on the top of those lights, and so it was not only that, but then, as they were coming down after this happened, they felt like they were on automatic. They felt like they were almost drifting down the hill into an area. And this area, even the daytime is tough to get through, but they just went through that. And the next thing they know, they have almost 4 hours of missing time, and they end up in a restaurant up the coast and they have no recollection of what happened. They came to our support group meeting and they brought some photographs of a rash that they had on their body after this experience. They had gone to one doctor and he wasn't sure what it was. And then they decided to go to another doctor to get another opinion. And he wasn't sure what it was. The bottom line was they showed this picture to the group, to the support group, and almost without exception, each of them had a similar rash. And the thing that blew my mind at this point was the fact, not just the fact that these other people had a similar rash, but the fact that one person in the group said, I know what that's from. So of course we're all sitting there with our mouths hanging open. And the person said, it's a reaction to the fluid that they dip you in to sanitize you when they bring you on board the craft. So anyway.
And who were they dealing with? What was the beings? Did they do regression to find out what the beings were?
The couple decided not to do that. Okay. They didn't want to go any further. They were really shaken up by this. And the fact, matter of fact, I got a call. This happened in the early 90s. I got a call from the man that was involved with this thing about 2 months ago. And he said, wow. I just need to talk to you to go over this case again and, you know, try to reassure him that, you know, he's okay. He's going to be fine. And that probably if he hasn't had an experience since then, it's probably not going to happen again.
But why were Tony?
The triangles, the crafts that they saw, were they the solid 3-point triangle or were they more of the chevron shape?
No, it was a solid. It was a solid. Yeah.
Okay.
So these support group meetings were really, really, really informative. And this one session I had, one of the people in the group said to me, he says, oh, I've seen you before. I said, really, where? You know, at the UFO conference or something. And, oh, no, I saw you on board the craft. I said, really? I said, that's interesting. Of course, I kind of blew it off because I have no conscious recollection of it. It was probably a year and a half later that another person, totally different person, said the same thing to me. He says, I've seen you before. I said, where? At the conference? I said, no. I saw you on board the craft. You were sitting on this bench naked and you were freaking out. And they told me to go over to you to calm you down. Well, after that conversation, I said, okay, I'm going to go get regressed and see if I can find something, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, the fact of the matter is I had 3 regressions. I had no recollection whatsoever of any contact with any aliens, if you will. But I had multiple past lives. And so, you know, you asked the question earlier, Grant, as far as, you know, why am I doing what I'm doing? You know, and are we selected in some way, shape or form to do what we are doing? And that's a really good question. Every time I decide that, okay, this is enough, I'm just going to go read books or something, you know. I get pulled back in. I get a phone call or I get an email or I get something that says, no, you got to do what you're doing and keep doing it.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say before we move too far ahead into the past life and regression, I just want to frame this a little bit. What year was this where you were trying to seek regression therapy? And was it hard for you to find resources at the time? And is that what led you into starting Opus and joining the ERT? So.
Right. Well, at the time, this again is in the 90s, okay? Mm-hmm. The late 90s, probably at this point, luckily, through my association with MUFON and the meetings that we had there locally, there was a person there by the name of June Steiner, who's a therapist. And so one of my regressions was with her. So I was lucky in the fact that I was able to find someone. But going back, you know, and then I found another person again through one of these conferences I just happened to be talking to someone and, you know, it came up. And so the next thing I know, I'm having a regression with this person. Matter of fact, I had two with that person.
Yeah. And these were in the days when MUFON was kind of more strictly adhering to nuts and bolts. So when experiencers would need to seek help, the experiencer response team, or I think it has a new name now, they yes. didn't even exist. So it kind of was word of mouth or talk to so-and-so. And
matter of fact, we can back up here a little bit. I'll give you some background on this thing. In around 2007, I was talking to James Carrion, who at the time was the international director for MUFON. And as you say, MUFON was pretty much a nuts and bolts organization up to that point. And I said, what are you doing with people that are calling in and looking for either therapists or something, you know, some kind of help, a support group? And so we worked out a deal where actually all the phone calls that were coming in to MUFON were forwarded to me, okay? And then I was able to contact these people. I got a recorded phone call. Matter of fact, I have a whole lot of those still. And the conversations are amazing, the things that they left on the voicemails. But the bottom line was that OPUS at that point, Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support, which is a nonprofit, was started by myself and Dr. Eugene Lipson in 1994. After a woman down in Carmel, California said, hey, can you guys help me? And because I was written up in an article in the Monterey Coast Weekly paper about what I was doing. And we went down there. She, after a near-death experience, became very psychic. And she was telling us stuff about ourselves that there was no way that she could possibly, know this information. Matter of fact, when we walked into her house, there was a picture on the wall of her standing on the back of a large boat. And so I asked her, I said, what's this about? She says, oh yeah, that's me on this boat with these gentlemen, and we're hunting for treasure. I said, you're hunting for treasure? I said, in this where? And she said, in the Caribbean. And I said, well, how are you involved with it? She says, well, I was actually in communication with the captain of the galleon that went down. Okay. So that started the afternoon, you know, and my head went boom after that. So, we went away from that meeting, and I talked to my friend, Dr. Lipson, and I said, look, how can we possibly help these people? And that was how OPUS got started. And, we've been doing our thing ever since.
That's so amazing. Like, you know, and even I think Grant can attest to this. And now that our community is kind of more online, I think probably once a week I have somebody ask me if I can direct them on where to go. And one of the first is always the ERT for me. I mean, it's right. established, it's been there. And you guys really do amazing work and help so many people. And I think, like you've said before, that is what it comes down to, is the experiencers being able to speak about what's going on with them in a safe space. And they end up helping each other more than anything else, more than finding answers to anything definitive. Right. But, go ahead.
I was going to say that, the ERT, which is now called the Experiencer Resource mm-hmm. Team, okay, they took out the research. It's the resource team. I'm a research consultant for them. And also OPUS is one of the things on their list of support groups. Mm-hmm. So that when somebody does need a support group, we have that ability, because we have an online support group, which is totally confidential. And we have over 200 people from around the world that are talking 24/7 with one another about their experiences. And so there's probably now, email-wise, I think it's over 35,000 emails that are in there talking about all their experiences, which are phenomenal.
Wow.
You know, we're talking about most recently about after a missing time episode, that now they're hearing children's voices and they're hearing knocking. And I've never heard that before. And this just came up recently, and a lot of them responded to that. And they're talking about deja vu within deja vu.
The different kinds of deja vu.
I mean, you talk about going down a rabbit hole. This thing just gets wider and wider and more incredible all the time.
Before we move on, I'll kick it to Grant, but one more question. I think you're perfect to ask for this since you've been involved since the inception of the experiencer support group and Opus, and you've been a field investigator with MUFON for so long as well. What is your opinion of the shift of just nuts and bolts for MUFON? I mean, I hear about it all the time in such a negative light. It's like, oh, MUFON needs to get back to the nuts and bolts there, blah. But I know when you speak to experiencers, contactees, abductees, it's like MUFON took a leap into the next century, you know, and is what it is today. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think I'm a little bit prejudiced here because I believe I was a real guiding force to get them to really look at this. And, mm-hmm. Back in the 2007 time frame. So for me, I always look at it and say, who better to understand this phenomenon than the people that are experiencing it in a very intimate way? And so, Kathleen Martin, who's basically the director of the ERT, and George Medich, who's assistant, great people, and really have their heart and soul in the right place to try to, number one, help people, but also to understand the phenomena, and to see if we can learn something. And I think we're going to probably talk about the Omega-3 study that I was involved with Opus and MUFON, who actually funded that study. And then the follow-on that's going to happen, which I'm in the middle of right now, the Omega-4 study with Russ Scalpone, who was involved with the free study. So, we're picking away at this thing and trying to better understand it.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the, you're mentioning James Carrion and the whole, when they started with the Bigelow and the STAR team and all that kind of stuff, were they looking at experiences? Because I think Chris Bledsoe has stated that he was the first case that they took on. So was Kathy Martin involved then, or what kind of cases were they looking at? Hard evidence cases or experiencer cases, like when they first started the STAR team and all that kind of stuff, where Bigelow was putting the money in?
Yeah, I wasn't involved with the STAR team part of it. I was kind of over here somewhere, doing my thing with the cases that were coming in that I could help either by sending them to a support group or a therapist, which is the case that most people are looking for, to get a therapist that's familiar with the topic. But I really can't address that for you, Grant.
Okay. Well, so when did the shift take place? When was where they actually made the move to say, okay, we're going to deal with the experiences? Because I've got the same thing with that Sinead, or that Nicole points out, is people saying, well, this is anecdotal, we need hardcore evidence and all this kind of stuff. And I think would say the whole UFO field, there's really nothing you can really pin down when you start really looking at it. I think you described this, it gets more and more and more complex the more you look at it. So when did that shift take place? And were you were involved, you said, with this?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, like I said, 2007 is when I talked to James, and he gave us the okay to start working together. And then they asked us to get involved with a study. And that's how the Omega-3 study came out. That was about 2009. We actually presented it at the symposium in Denver in 2009. Or 2010, I forget exactly what year it was, but so, you know, I think that was the key time frame that they finally said, okay, this is something, you know, that we need to pay more attention to. And then of course Kathleen Martin, you know, came into the picture thereafter. Gosh, I'm absolutely terrible with dates. It's like, I have a hard time remembering what I had for dinner last night. No,
yeah.
It's years and years ago. But that was really the beginning of it. It was received very well. So I think they finally, you know, with the advent of the ERT, which was preceded by the AERC, the Abduction Experiencer Research Committee, which I chairmaned, and got people involved with that. Some pretty interesting names, as a matter of fact. We had Rick Straussman, you know, the DMT.
You had him?
Yeah, we had him on the committee. And
so what was his input on there?
Well, basically what it was is that he was... We were bouncing things off of him where he was giving us feedback on it. Like, okay, I think, you know, that's a good place to ask questions, and maybe we need to, you know, define that a little bit better. So overall, it was basically as an advisor that he was giving us.
Did you get into discussions of his DMT elves? The idea that 50% of the people that he, I think, was claiming that we're seeing the elves, and he didn't really describe it to anybody. And then quarter of the people were having like abduction experiences where they're on a table and stuff like that. Did you go through that whole thing with him? The correlation between the DMT experience and the abduction experience?
Well, you know, we kind of knew about that, of course, and so that's why when we did the survey, the Omega-3 study, you know, we tried to look at as much of that as possible within the realm of the questionnaires. And so some of that is a little bit difficult to handle. It's like you need to, you know, have the electrodes on the top of your head and stimulate certain parts of your brain to initiate certain things, you know. Now we're talking about the left temporal lobe and the right temporal lobe and things of that nature, where if you block one, then all of a sudden the right temporal lobe takes over. If you block the left side, and then all these things start to come about. And then the DMT may be part of that ability to block certain things on the left side, you know, which is our more rational side, so to speak, and then have the right brain take over and say, okay, we're going for a trip, folks. Let's, you know.
So let me ask you again, because I just finished a book on psychedelics. So let me ask you another question about this. So when you saw this, I mean, and I think you've discussed this before, the idea that abduction experiences may not be as physical as people think they are, that it may be some sort of astral type thing. And that's what you get with the DMT thing, is the person's on the couch, they aren't going anywhere, and they're describing this. So just right. Your personal opinion, the connection between the two, do you think there's a connection there where they say the default mode network is shut down? And because I always wonder with the beings, like, why do they wake the person up and scare the living daylights out of them and then tell them to go back to sleep again? It's like they're forcing them to dissociate almost. And yes. I was always interested in that connection that and Straussman, I think he realized that, because I think, yeah, you know, he was asking people like, have you been abducted? And they go, no, I don't think so. It's like, and he was puzzled, like, what is going on here? So right. Just your personal opinion, what do you think there's a connection between the two, this physical, this spiritual aspect or psychic aspect, whatever you want to call it?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the experiences always talk about, well, I had this dream. you know, and was it really a dream? You know, was it a out of body experience, or was it a physical manifestation that, you know, you were taken out through a wall or something like that? But I think there the technology that's involved with this, that they seem to be able to do, where they break you down, you know, in a way that they're able to do that. But again, as you say, you know, the out of body stuff is really interesting, because your essence, your energy is moving. It's going someplace. It's leaving your body, and it's having this experience, and it's real. It's absolutely real. It's like, you know, people say after you die, well, you know, there's still life after death. And this energy that I'm just amazed sometimes when I look at an ant, and this little guy is running around. He's got this energy inside him, right? And then all of a sudden, if you happen to step on him, what happens? Where does that energy go? It goes somewhere. It's not just because you step on them. That energy is still viable. And I think it's energy is viable in us. And so when you're sleeping at night and all of a sudden you have this feeling that you're floating and you're going out of body, it's that energy. It's that energy. And these aliens, if you will, can manipulate that in some way, shape, or form. They have access to that. So, and then of course there are physical instances where people are absolutely taken and paralyzed and then taken on board a craft and probed and all this.
Can I jump in? And Les, I would just like it if you could maybe run through the Omega-3 survey for us, or and maybe tell us what maybe your top three or top five most interesting findings. Or
And what we did, we took 71 people that were claimed to have been abducted, and 51 people as a control group. And so what I'm going to do is, the easiest way for me to do this, and I think it'll be the most informative this way, is let me just read this to you, okay? Mm-hmm. In general, abductees' experiences profile differently than do their comparison counterparts on a number of general psychological and specific neurological variables. Yet there are remarkable similarities between the experiential group and the comparison group. It should be noted that in no case that experiencers or comparison group participants show any signs of mental illness or personality disorder. So that's a really big factor right there. They did not have a psychopathology. Fantasy proneness, which is something that, you know, people bring up all the time, though all these people are just, you know, making this stuff up. Fantasy proneness does not appear to play a differentiating role between the experiential and the control groups. However, sensitivity to alternative realities and early and recurrent paranormal or psi experiences seem to play a role in the abduction experience. Here's another thing that's kind of interesting, and it's been brought up before as well. Childhood conflict, psychosocial tension and abuse and trauma more than likely facilitate a dissociative coping style in later life. And dissociation, again, is this ability somehow to close down the left brain and the right brain takes over. Let's see, how much a part of dissociation plays in abduction experience remains an open question, but the Ring and Rosing, this is two gentlemen that did previous analysis back in 1990, abuse trauma dissociation pathway remains a viable descriptive, if not explanatory, principle. Both experience with and interest in the abduction phenomena have impact on how one's body is perceived to function, how one views the world, and one's purpose in it. and how one defines or redefines one's faith, tradition, and beliefs. In essence, both experience with and interest in contact seem to change one's sense of self and one's worldview. And you hear about this all the time, that after these things happen, we need to be better to, you know, the environment, take care of our ecology, be better with one another, love one another. They're all very positive things that seem to come out of this thing. Abductees' experiences believe that there is a sentient, purposive alien intelligence at play in their lives and at work in the world. What the intelligence's goals are seem to be more beneficent than malevolent, more benign than malignant. This, though, remains an open question and a point of doubt in the minds and hearts of some abductees' experiences and some comparison control participants. It also remains a point of contention among abduction researchers. Yes, indeed. The brain, now this is another interesting part. The temporal lobe is being talked about a lot lately. The brain generally in the temporal lobes and limbic system more particularly play a mediating role in the anomalous experiences such as abduction. This in no way implies that abductions are all or only in the abductees' heads. Rather, it points to the likelihood of temporal lobe lability, which is, in other words, being open to change, as a preset or a precursor to extraordinary experiences. While it would be too reductionistic to claim that the brain creates such experiences, it is not far-fetched to think that the brain plays an important part in the who and the what of extraordinary experiences and how they are interpreted. So that's probably the meat of the conclusion that we came up with. And of course, we said after that that we needed to continue to look at this. And so the Omega 4 study is in process right now, where we're going to do this differently now. What we're going to do, which I don't think anybody has done, is we're going out to therapists first. The first phase is to go out to therapists with a questionnaire. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to ask those therapists to go to their clients, the experiencers, and ask them to participate in the survey. And we're hoping to do the survey with the experiencers in two phases as well. So it's going to be a lengthy process. We probably won't be done with this for about a year. But the first phase with the therapist, I think we'll be able to get done in probably 4 or 5 months. And then we have to go out to the experiencers themselves.
Nice. Did we lose Grant? Oh,
I'm
no,
here.
He's here. I wanted to kind of kick this over and get your opinions. Back to the nuts and bolts a little. I hear a lot of nuts and bolts researchers question what consciousness has to do with UFOs. So I was wondering if maybe through both of your experiences, dealing with experiencers and your love of consciousness and studying that, yeah, give us your opinions on that and tell us how consciousness ties in to the near-death experience, the psychic abilities, how the paranormal isn't as far from ufology as some people think it is.
Well, again, I think that when you're dealing with these entities and their capabilities, you have to scratch your head and say, okay, is this purely a technical, you know, scientifically based phenomena? And I don't think it is. And I think that I don't know if we'll ever be able to fully understand it on a scientific basis. I think that, our energy, our consciousness is something that, we're all tied together in that regard. And there's a larger overarching consciousness that's out there seemingly that has some kind of control. Of course, people say that God made humanity in his image. And then I wonder, well, what about the aliens? Did God make the aliens in his image too? I think that, it's a very complicated subject. You can't just say it's this or that. It's a whole plethora of things that come together to manifest in a way that we just still don't understand. How is that possible that a person can be literally maybe in two places at the same time? Part of their essence is here and another part of their essence is over here. It's not an easy subject. I mean, what is consciousness? People really explain that yet fully? I don't think so, but I always look at it as energy. It's something that when, as they say, there's life after death. I mean, there's all these people out there that have had near-death experiences that talk about what happened to them. Like this one particular doctor that was down in South America on a canoe trip and was caught under a falls for 30 minutes. most people would probably be dead by that point. And she saw these entities and it was very loving and she didn't want to go, back. And they said, no, you have to go back because you have important things to do. And then they also told her, this part really blew my mind, that her son, who was very young, said that when he turned 18, he would die. And they told her this, which to me was unbelievable. Long story short, when he turned 18, shortly after he was killed in an automobile accident. Wow. And she
let me jump in here with a question related to that, because I think you mentioned in a number of interviews, you have got people coming forward now who believe something's about to happen. And usually, from my experience, the experiencers, the visions they get are not like grandma is here with a message, she loves you, this kind of stuff. I saw 9/11. I had six people saw 9/11. It's, the one guy saw the fires in Australia a year before they occurred. You see these really catastrophic thing. So what do you advise somebody? Because when these people come forward with these, and you can confirm to me whether people are starting more and more to do this, it's a pretty traumatic thing. You got to come forward and say you saw New York being destroyed or something like that. And what do you think about all that?
Well, there's a lady up in Canada. I don't know if you know her, Patricia Mona. I don't know if you've ever heard of her.
No.
She's a psychic, and she's worked with the police departments, finding bodies, and but also telling people about their future lives. And so, psychic ability is real. I mean, these people can see not only the past, the present, but also the future. And so, there's no such thing as time.
Yeah.
It's just this continuum that you can tap into. And so I totally believe that these people have that ability. And some people can handle it and other people have a real hard time with that. A matter of fact, the support group, the Opus support group, has been talking about everybody feeling something significant supposed to be happening, but nobody could really, pinpoint it as to what it might be. But then there was one person in our group that was evidently did mention something about the fact that the 9/11 incident was something that came up to her, right around that time. And, said, yeah, it happened afterwards. And, she felt terrible and she didn't know who to talk to about it. And that's another factor. These people are kind of trapped in a way as to, what do I do with this information? Who do I call?
And who's cataloging? Because I think you had the connection with Free. I was involved with Free when Race first had his vision, I had actually given a consciousness lecture days before. He was with me when I gave this lecture, and a couple of days he had that vision where that it's all consciousness and quit parsing everything and all that kind of stuff. And they've got the stats. I don't know what their stat is, but I'm kind of disappointed they sort of took it offline, because it was really interesting stuff. Like the thing where, you know, 37% of all abductees have near-death experiences. And it's like, well, and then you start wondering, like, is this a random event? What's the chances that you're going to, number one, be an experiencer and get taken on a ship and also have a near-death experience? And a lot of them have two near-death experiences. I remember asking Yvonne Smith, I said, Yvonne, like, how many of these people that you work with, how many of them are psychic? She started laughing. She said, like 100% maybe. It's like, and so you see these connections. So
yeah.
did they discuss this in the experiencer group about this common thing where it's almost like they've ripped the veil and they're in this, they're part in this world and part in another world, and they're picking up stuff and stuff like that. And do you have any way to support them on that kind of stuff?
Well, as a matter of fact, the best thing that we offer in cases like that is the fact that the support group itself, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, that they're talking 24/7 with one another, and somebody will bring up a fact like that, and then somebody will back them up and say, yeah, I know, I've had a similar thing happen. And so they start talking with one another, and so the whole, you know, thread starts to happen, and then they go off, and you know, I'm able to see the whole thing. Here we go again. You know, it's like abduction, near death experience.
Because you have that. It's to me, that's the important thing. I remember I asked Ray, like I do the people who've flown the craft. I don't know if you've had any of your people fly the craft. I had the first one in 2013. I got 50 people. The free survey showed that 14% of all experiencers claimed they'd flown the craft. And I said, don't think you should check these people. Like, I mean, this is, you see these very bizarre statistics, or 50% are healed. 50% claim that they can heal other people after they had an experience. 40%, you can probably talk about this. 40% say at one point during their experience, they knew the answer to everything in the universe. 42% they got mathematical, scientific, or technical material in their head that they didn't learn in school. And I've had it, and you probably had it too, where they come up and say, hey, guess what? Look at this paper I wrote. And they have no mathematical background.
Right.
And it's got formulas and stuff. And it's sort of, to me, that's where I think that people are missing the boat with the experiencers, is if someone says that they've got mathematical, scientific, or technical material, 42%, or they say they knew the answer to everything in the universe and it faded away. Don't you think we should talk to these people and maybe try to find out what's going on?
I would hope so. And I think some people have actually had, you know, various mathematicians or scientists look at their scribblings and found out, well, wait a minute. Yeah, that is a valid formula. And, whether or not it's something that's going to give us zero point energy or something else, I don't know. I haven't seen anything yet. And that's unless, of course, the government has sucked it up and now we'll never see it. We'll never see the light of day.
Well, let me ask you a question related to that, because I've had one just recently come to me with this paper that is like, I don't know, 100 pages long and diagrams and all this kind of stuff. I had no idea where to send it. Free used to have a group, a physics group, to look. They don't have that physics group anymore. So these people are, I didn't know where to send this paper. And so I think it's kind of, these people are sort of out there. And I know that if you know the story of Tyler D, who is in American Cosmic, he's the NASA guy, the head NASA guy. He deals with experiences. I had an encounter with him in 2013. He actually introduced me to an experiencer, because he had a download. So did Gary Nolan, all these guys. You find out these, like Bob Bigelow had the beings in his room when he was a little kid. You start realizing, oh man, all these people are down the same rabbit hole as you and I.
Yeah.
And I remember Tyler D introduced me to a girl who lived in Canada, now lives in Florida, where Tyler D is. And he was getting her to record all her visions that she was getting, all the things that she was, and she was logging all this stuff for him. And she actually gave me some of them, and I actually found them. And she got pretty upset, like emotional, when I started to confirm these things that she'd seen in her visions and stuff like that. He was logging all this kind of stuff. And that's where I think we need to look at this kind of stuff where I really don't know where to send these people when they have this kind of stuff.
Have you thought about Robert Powell, to send it to Robert Powell, his group?
Yeah, he's a possibility. I've talked to him a few times, but that's the thing is we've got this material, these people who are getting this stuff. They seem to be in another world where they're picking up, I call them right blocks. We've got a bunch of wrong blocks, because there's, if this stuff was all this paranormal stuff means that we're missing something. We're missing some pieces that we've got. We're making it false assumptions, and that these people are sort of giving us the answer that if you look at them long enough, you're going to figure out, oh, they've got this right and we've got that wrong, and you can figure it out. But it seems like these people are sort of still off where they're talking among themselves, but I'm not sure anybody's really seriously looking at the material that they've got or the stuff that they've encountered, which I think is critically important. That's the only thing you can really have, because the sighting stuff, you know, you can count how many red ones and green ones and fast ones and slow ones. It really doesn't get you anywhere when these people are being given, and you probably can confirm this, they're given actual material. The beings are actually telling them how the craft works, how the universe works, how everything works and stuff like that. And so I'm glad you're working with them. I just think we're still a little bit far behind in terms of not paying enough attention to them the way they should be paying attention.
Yeah, and you know, there's these people that are savants, that have certain skills. And evidently, there's a gentleman by the name of Alan Schneider, who's done some interesting tests by stimulating TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation of the left anterior temporal lobe. And he's been able to create savants. Yeah. Normal people. So what is that? And, you know, I think that just because maybe somebody is a savant or has Asperger's or something like that on the autistic spectrum, that they may, even though they may not act totally right, they may have some really interesting information. And matter of fact, Russ and I will be talking to Mary Rodwell tomorrow night with regard to that, because she's very much interested in that whole subject. And so we might be incorporating that into our Omega 4 study as well. So there's so many places you can go with this stuff. I mean, it's
I'll jump in with two questions here. The first question, I guess, in all your research over the decades, obviously, I'm sure you've come across lots of experiences with the grays, the gray aliens. Uh-huh. In your opinion, what do you think the grays are, and has that changed over the years?
I don't think it's changed much over the years. I think they're, you know, part biological, part robotic in nature. They're kind of the drones, if you will. And you know, the tall grays are the ones directing them, and then behind that you have the mantid type people and entities, and then you might have a few Nordics running around, and maybe even a reptilian to throw in into the mix. Depending upon what's happening. I don't think it's changed much since the beginning stages. Of course, the colors may change a little bit. There may be, instead of grays, they may be brown or they may be blue. So there's some more color combinations that seem to be prevalent as well.
Let me jump in with a question there, because I'm interested in this area. Do the people that you have always see the same beings? Because what I find is that when you go to people and you get their experience, if you look over their whole lifetime, it starts with one being and then it turns off to another being, and then there's suddenly a different type of being there. And so you either have a thing where they're being passed off from person to person, or I'll give you an example. Reptilians, I don't think were described till 1988. I helped a girl publish a book, and I wrote the foreword for her second book. She's a reptilian experiencer. And so she was telling me the stories, and she's got the hybrid child. It's there, it looks like a reptilian and all this kind of stuff. And then when I'm looking at her first book, I go, hey, so I go, Nancy, can I ask you a question here? You were taken in 1962. Yeah. And Mr. She calls him Mr. And this is the reptilian. I said, Mr. was on the ship. Yeah. So what do you look like? Said, oh, he's a human being with ordinary hair. And I said, did you ever ask him if he was an alien? And she said, yeah, he said he was from Earth. He's never, and basically said, no, really not an alien. And the other one that I can bring up is Sherry Wilde, who, if you know the story that she had, she's dealing with a Zeta, who's mostly from Zeta Reticuli. Uh-huh. And he says, I'm from Andromeda. She takes the book to the publisher, and the publisher said, hey, Nancy, or Sherry, something's wrong here. He can't be from Andromeda. He's a Zeta. So, and she said, really? And he said, yeah, go and ask him what's going on here. So she goes and says, you said you're from Andromeda and you're a Zeta. So like, are you an alien or what are you? And he said, no, that would not best describe what I am. I'm an etheric being. And he said, we use the theta body. We use the gray body because it's the most, what do you call it? It's a good fit for us. It's easier than a physical body. And so that's the question I want to ask you is like, because you started in 57. So you have 1950s. It's all human beings. They're going for rides on ships. Suddenly Betty and Barney Hill get abducted. And suddenly we get this absolute shift around where suddenly they're no longer from Venus and Mars and the moon. Now they're from Zeta Reticuli and the Pleiades and Andromeda and stuff like that. In the 1890s, when they asked them, they said, oh, we're from Mars. We have this wooden ship and we came from Mars and stuff like that. And so what do you think about all that? Are the aliens actually aliens and are they impersonating aliens or because you see these stories where people, the beings seem to change, or as you know, when it first starts, the experience is very negative. And after they had like 10 experiences, suddenly it's like the free survey showed 83% say if they had the chance positive. To shut it down, they would not shut it down.
Right. That was my second question. I was going to say the evolution of bad to good.
that's a good question. And matter of fact, that's we talked about that today. We were talking with Don Deary today of the ERT group. We kind of think that the free study was skewed in a way because of the fact that they went out to just a whole plethora of people. And based on the overall feeling that these people had, based on the knowledge of who the people were involved, where Ray went out to get these people, okay, was maybe more positive. So that's why we're so interested now in doing it through the therapist, because these people obviously have an issue, and that's why they went to a therapist. So we may get a whole different skew on this thing. But as far as your original question, all the people that I have ever worked with, you know, since my involvement with MUFON in the early 90s, have all been mostly grays, predominantly grays, and then you had reptilians, and then you had mantid type people, and then you had Nordic type people, and you had the military. You had military too. That's a whole nother ball game. Is it something that at the time, how do we describe these entities? Back in the biblical times, they were angels, or they were demons, or they were something else. They weren't aliens. So it's whatever your mindset is and whatever your background is, how you describe these things. So I think these things probably show up and appear to the person as what, you hear these things where they shapeshift and they appear as an owl, or they appear as some other creature that you're comfortable with. And then, if you're able to see through it, and some people have the ability to do that, they actually see the entity as it is. And then you have, forget the ones that are quote unquote solid, you have ethereal type beings, you know, light beings, you have, you know, whole gamut of creatures that seem to have some type of intelligence and are interacting with the abductee.
Okay, let me continue with that. If you've read Peniston's book, Peniston has a conversation with Kit Green, and Kit Green is doing this study on experiencers. He's got eight people on the experiencer team. Department of Defense money seems to be coming from Bigelow. He confirms this, and he says in there, he says, basically, the people see what they want to see. It's influenced by their religious background or what they really believe, that kind of stuff. And then you take a look, for example, if you look at the even the abduction thing, if you look at the you're familiar with the Wilson leak document where at the end it says there are no abductions. Kit Green says exactly the same thing. Kit Green says no abductions ever. I went and looked at all the people on the NIDS board that would have got that paper. I looked at Edgar Mitchell. Edgar Mitchell says, nope, no abductions. Jacques Vallée laughs at the abduction scenario. And so I couldn't find anybody that really went along with the abduction scenario. And it was this idea that it may be more of a mental phenomena than we really think it is. And so what do you say to like Kit Green, who says no abductions ever? And this is the guy who ran the weird desk of the CIA and is running the big experiencer survey where they're doing the DNA and the Caudette Pudaemon and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, that they would come out and say that. So then what, is it some type of a psychopathology we don't understand or some type of a mental thing that, and that's, I mean, it could be, it absolutely could be, you know, and that's part of what we're trying to do with this Omega-4 study too, is to really try to look at this thing and, you know, dig in a little bit deeper and hopefully with the help of the therapists with their part of the survey, to try to better understand, you know, truly what is going on with these people. But, you know, they come back with all kinds of things where, you know, they have the wrong clothes on, or they have, you know, marks on their body that are unexplainable. They have implants in their, you know, good old Roger Lear, you know, took out a lot of implants and, you know, had some pretty unusual things with regard to the implants as far as transmitting frequencies and things of that nature. So maybe it's military, you know, why would the military be involved if there wasn't something more going on?
Yeah. Let me bring up another thing. The thing with the body marks, I have the same sort of, I wanted to ask you about that. How many people have the triangles? Because it's like, why would if you're an alien and you're abducting somebody for their sperm, what are you putting a triangle on the person for? And I've got some pretty clear triangles on people's bodies. And it's sort of like, it's like, no, this is for real. This wasn't a dream. No, this is actually happening. Or the, you know, guys with cuts in their head in the crown of their head and stuff like that, experiencers where they're asking me, why would they do this? Or why would they put people's clothes on backwards? People think it's because the aliens are stupid. And it seems to be like, no, your clothes are inside and out backwards because we want you to know that wasn't a dream. This really happened, that kind of stuff. One thing I want to bring up, and this again goes to this thing of who the aliens are, is this statement. I don't know if you saw the debate between John Mack and Bud Hopkins. It wasn't a debate. It was a discussion in Boston many years ago. And at one point, Mack says, you know, Bud, it's really strange. You know, I'm the psychiatrist here. You think I'd be getting all the real bad ones? He says, I'm getting all the spiritual seeking ones. You're getting all the bad ones. And maybe that has more to do with you and I than it does with the aliens. And it's that idea where you can probably confirm this, people who actually see two different things and they're standing right beside each other.
Oh, yeah.
The one with the triangle, where the woman sees the triangle and it's got a triangle inside the triangle. And the other woman said, no, it didn't. Had sparklers coming off it. There's just sparklers. It wasn't a triangle and two different things. And I guess it goes back to this consciousness. Is there really a physical world, or is this all, as Deepak Chopra says, an action? Everything is an action inside consciousness. That it's this consciousness thing that maybe what you and I are running up against, because you'll see people are talking about really weird consciousness things that are going on in their life. And you have the little bit of the physical stuff, but it's this weird sort of, you start wondering, or let me ask you a question here about the orbs. So you talked about the orbs. Mm-hmm. Now, and a lot of people, and you can tell this, you have one particular story you tell about the orbs where the, you can see the beings in there. So we have one guy, I helped him publish his book out of Israel, who talks about these green beings who, when they left the room, they all held hands and they started making a circle and they started going around in the circle and around and around and went faster and faster and faster. And then they became translucent. Then they turned into a ball of light and the ball disappeared. So the question is it actually a flesh and blood alien or is it a ball of light? And that's this whole question. What are we really dealing with here? So tell me your orb story. You've got some stories about orbs. About
I had gone to Sedona and met up with Mr. Dongo, and he says you need to meet this lady. She's got some really interesting orb pictures. And I said, really? So ended up having a lunch with her the day after. And she says, I want you to come on out to the house and after dark, and then we're gonna sit out there and then we're gonna observe what's going on. And so I was sitting out there on the porch, and she says, I get a feeling, okay, that when an orb is about to appear, I'll start taking pictures, and I'll just, one right after the next, I'll just start, you know, pushing the camera and taking pictures. And so I said, okay. And well, sure enough, she says, okay, I think they're starting to happen. And she starts taking pictures. And the first couple weren't orbs. They were like snakes. They were light snakes. Okay.
Yeah.
But then she says, okay, I'm going to the corner of the house. I'm going to take a picture of you. So I'm sitting there, and I've got a camera, and I'm taking pictures myself. And she starts clicking away, and there's this orb over my head, a reddish orb, and it had like this little yellow cap on it one side. And of course, as she was taking these pictures, still pictures, the thing moved. And she didn't move. She didn't move her camera or anything. I mean, she was nailed against the side of the house. She was using it as a brace. And so it wasn't a movement of the camera or anything, but this thing was moving above my head. So, I mean, it was like, okay, what in the heck is that? But then she says, I want you to come in the house. I have much bigger, better pictures of orbs that I've taken, and I've blown them up. And so I took a look at this one, and I swear to God, you would see an alien, a gray alien, looking out of the orb, and then there was one behind him looking in another direction, and another one on the other side looking in a third direction. And it's like, okay, so what are these things? Portals, mini portals of some sort, where these entities are able to see whatever they're, you know, wherever they want to go, or see whatever they want to see through this device.
You started in 57. You must sort of agree with me that you never would have believed that stuff would happen. Like, I mean, we had 57. I mean, they had the angel hair, which doesn't happen anymore. We had the crafts with the balls on them, the crafts with windows. We don't have that anymore. Then the crop circles start. And then the same with you. Like, suddenly these orb people appear and they got orbs. And then people are doing light language stuff. And you're going like, what is, do you think it's getting more complex, more like they're unraveling something? Because it seems like we're actually losing ground in terms of trying to understand, because in the 50s, everybody said, oh, it's just an alien from Mars or Venus, and they're here and they've discovered us and stuff. And now, I mean, that's the last thing you'd think is going on.
Yeah, I think it definitely is more complex. I think we've technologically, we've come a lot further back since the 50s. We have, you know, various devices to record these things. We have experimentation by, you know, various scientists with regard to the brain. So there's a lot of activity going on that just wasn't happening back in the 50s. So yeah, what's happening is that rabbit hole is getting bigger and bigger, and it, you know, a lot more is coming, to fruition as far as questioning what is really going on. We're not just, who talked about consciousness in the 50s? Nobody. Exactly. You know? So yeah, it's definitely expanding, and you know, it's people like yourself that are asking great questions, you know, causing people to really think more about these issues, and you know, hopefully we'll get people, you know, other scientists or other philosophers or whoever to really do a better job and looking at this, because we definitely need to better understand it. You know, are we living in a matrix? Maybe.
The only thing I would add to that is I think the experiencer stories have to be sort of promoted, because we often will go outside of the community, like for whatever scientists, but then it becomes to me like, you know, you're talking to the Pope about sex and marriage, which he knows nothing about. That just because some guy's got a PhD, I remember I used to, in university, the dean of plant science used to argue with me, and one time I suddenly said, you're a plant scientist, you know how to do a rose, you know nothing about UFOs, and he shut up. And that's the thing, is like, I still think the experiencers aren't getting enough voice, that what they're talking about, when you start stringing the stuff that they're saying, stringing it together, you start realizing, oh, you know, like they're telling you what's going on. And they, you know, you have the support group, but still, I have said, well, I've said that for years, that they just don't get the support that, in terms of people listening to them.
There's a double-edged sword with all of that. Of course, these people are very reticent about coming forward and talking. Absolutely. Because they fear, you know, being ridiculed, and you know, they don't get the kind of support from family members most of the time. You know, there's all kinds of issues with that and that, and so it's a difficult thing. But you know, I'm seeing more and more books coming out. I mean, you know, here's Terry Lovelace with a really good book about this whole topic, and then in the new book, the Reckoning, he has a whole bunch of people that contacted him afterwards that are experiencers, and their stories are in there. And I'm actually working on a book myself in that regard. Right. So, you know, but. Yeah, I think you're going to see more and more books coming out. Matter of fact, the people in my support group, in the Opus support group, there's three or four of them that are talking about writing books. So, you know.
Excellent. That's what I encourage people. I actually help people, experiencers, to, because I have a publishing company, we can sort of help them set it up. We're actually help them, because I say, you've got a journalist, even for your kids, that they know what's going on. And what I find, maybe you can correct me if you've seen this, that once somebody does go public and they realize that the world didn't collapse or whatever, suddenly they become like the Messiah. And it's like, oh my God, you know, like they really gain power when they go public. And I always tell them, even if you don't put it out there. So I hope you encourage your people to at least journal it themselves.
Oh yeah.
That helps a lot, that they, and once they, my experience is, once you listen to them and you take them seriously, they'll tell you everything. So you can go to the government. The government's not going to tell you anything. It may know what's going on, but it's never going to tell you. But an experiencer, right, if they have your trust, they'll tell you exactly what happened. They won't leave any note.
That's a good point. The journaling, I tell them to do that all the time. And most of them are journaling, which is a really positive aspect of all of this, because you know, matter of fact, I got 21 pages the other day for the book from one experiencer. So I'm going to have to cut that down, because
wow,
21 pages of his journal, you know, and that's not all of it. That's not even all of it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really
well,
amazing
guys, stuff. I think we're coming up around an hour, and maybe a final thought here. I think, that we could leave our audience with is, I think all of us here know that when you're dealing with these experiences and how you start to sort through it, and when you do seek help and find other experiencers or contactees, the longer you continue with it, I think you find that this is an inner journey as much as a quest for knowledge. It's an inner journey and a spiritual journey and almost a personal quest. And what could you say to our audience who is maybe just starting this journey, and your thoughts on advice for them?
Yeah, and you hit it the nail right on the head. It is a spiritual journey, absolutely. You know, the beginning phases can be very, very frightening, very traumatic. Then there's an interim period where they become acceptant of the experiences, and they're more peaceful with what's going on. And then in the latter stages, a lot of times it stops. And then they say, well, why? Why is this stopped? You know, it's almost like the Stockholm syndrome that takes place. But the bottom line is that it is a journey. It's a process that goes on of you know, trying to better understand not only the outside world, but their world, their inner world. And they come out a better person, a much better person. You know, they try to be more kind to one another. They're concerned with the ecology of the planet. It's a very progressive, positive experience if they can go through that beginning phase of it, which some people can, most people can, but some people can't. And so they need more assistance. And that's why Opus was created, to help people having these paranormal experiences. And it's not just, we don't deal with just the abduction phenomena, but as it turns out, it seems like we've found our niche in doing a lot of that type of a thing. And so if people do need help, they can go to our website at opusnetwork.org, and there's a support button there, and you can hit that, and we'll be contacting you within 24 hours.
I've still got a couple of things I just want to go over. I'm really happy that you're encouraging. So a lot of times when I talk to experiencers, what I get from them is, like, for example, the woman with the triangles. Yeah. Okay. I know something's going on. They left me alone. She's an older woman, past her birth giving years, and now they're back and she wants to know, so what's going on? Why are they dealing with me? And you probably know that a lot of people have this sense of mission. Like, I'm supposed to do something. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. So what do you say to those people when they come to you as the authority and they want to know, like, why is this happening to me? What do you say to them?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's multiple reasons why it might be happening. I mean, it may be something that is generational. You know, I've had so many people's, after I asked them, I said, so did your parents or grandparents ever have an experience like this? And if they didn't know, soon thereafter, they might ask, and they find out, well, yeah, they did have an unusual experience. You know, they talk about the Native American lineage that seems to be followed. And then also military families that seem to have these things go on. There's not one particular thing, but it does seem overwhelmingly to be generational, where they seem to be following a bloodline for whatever reason. And you know, as far as what the mission is, some people, you know, for me, for instance, if I was abducted, it seems like my mission is to help people. Okay. And for these other people, they may not know what the mission is right now, but they're told that at some point you will know what your mission is. That seems to be very prevalent as well, is that they're told that you will know at the right time.
Okay. Excellent. Two last questions. What do you think the beings are about? Because people will talk about the hybrid program. So you take a guy and it'll take like 30 seconds to get the sperm, and the guy's on for 2 hours and he's taken, you know, every night or whatever. What do you think the beings are ultimately here? Do you think it's random first? Do you think it's random that they just happen to find us? Or what do you think their mission is?
Well, the mission is probably convoluted in the sense that, you know, that we've been told or people have said that, you know, they're doing this because they have issues and they need to do this in order to support their own civilization in some way, shape, or form. So if you believe that route, then, you know, they're basically, you know, trying to survive. But, you know, is it something like what we do with animals? You know, we'll take a dolphin, we'll pull them out of the water, we'll take a blood sample, we'll tag them, and we'll throw them in, and then a year later, we catch them again and do the same thing. Or is it some kind of a learning experience for their group? You know, it's like a school that's going on. So I think there's multiple ways that one can look at this thing, not just one particular way. And do they tell the truth? Who knows? Some people feel, yeah, they're very truthful. They're, you know, they've helped me in so many ways. And others say, nah, they're just a bunch of liars and, you know, they're going to just do whatever the hell they want to do. And so we're not at the top of the food chain. and so we're dealing with something that is we can't control.
So what percentage, sort of second tied in question, what percentage of the people in your experience, your people that belong to your group, are dealing with grays? Because you get a lot, like Chris Bledsoe didn't deal with grays. A lot of people didn't deal with grays. And in connection to that question, and then the question of the whole idea about the people that are flying the ship. So to me, it's like they're teaching people, they'd say, they're taking me to school. Can you get them to stop me taking to school? They take me to school every night and I've got to go to school and I got to work and they're bugging me and stuff like that. Where why would you teach someone to fly a ship? And so first the question about what percentage are the people that you're dealing with? Are they grays? And then
the majority are grays. The vast majority are grays. You know, and then it falls off to tall, you know, short grays, tall grays, mantis, and then reptilian and Nordic type. Comes up last. What was the other question there?
The thing is the whole thing with these people having these abilities, that they seem to be trained, like the psychic stuff or the Milab people. That's what the reports I always get is the Milab people are grabbed because they want to see what they've been trained. What are they teaching you? What are they telling you? What kind of abilities do these people have? Put a piece of machine in there. Can they make this piece of machine work because they can fly the craft and stuff like that? So
yeah, I've had a few people that, you know, that have flown the craft. It was more like, hey, you want to fly the craft. It was like, you know, it wasn't like, okay, I want you to sit down here and this is the control to go left. And this is the one for, you know, it wasn't like that. It was just like, oh, here, you want to fly this thing? And then, you know, they do it. And those particular cases, it's almost comical in a way, you know, these people have a sense of humor, or some of them do anyway.
Yeah. And it always involves consciousness, where you put your hand on a panel, you become one with the craft is alive. You know, Kathy Martin's assistant always talks about that. So my last question to you would be your book. Let's talk a little bit about your book. What will people learn from your book in terms of what you're trying to get out in the message?
What I'm trying to do in this book is first of all, give a brief history of Opus, of course, what we do. But talk about the various physical aspects of the phenomena. James McCampbell, who I knew very well, wrote a book about ufology and the physical effects of electromagnetic effects on people and what that does. So there's a portion in there. There's a portion that's going to be about Mario Bagaslini, who did a lot of, he collected a lot of writings that people did as far as symbolic writings and things of that nature. And certainly talking about the latest stuff that's going on. So trying to go through some of the more nuts and bolts, if you will, types of things, but also talking about, you know, are we dealing with extraterrestrials? Are we dealing with interdimensionals? Are we dealing with time travelers? Are we dealing with the military? Or are we dealing with all the above, which I kind of believe is the case. And so put a thing together that shows, hey, wait a minute, there's a lot of evidence here. It may not be proof as we know, but there's a lot of evidence, and that points to the fact that these people are not crazy, and something is going on. And then I conjecture about, you know, what that might be, and I'll have the omega-3 study in there, and depending upon when I get this thing out, we'll have the omega-4 study in there too, as well, in the appendix. So.
Beautiful. You talked about the aliens lying. Well, I lied too. I've got one more question. I said it was my last question. It's not. We have the odd conspiracy person listens in. So I've never had a threat from the government. I've been offered sort of, you know, documents and stuff like that. But have you had any run-ins in your long career with the government?
Well, I had an incident that occurred. This goes back probably 20 years. I won't mention the gentleman's name, but he was ex-Air Force. And I thought he was a friend. And I was investigating a crashed UFO incident. And basically, I was talking to him about this show that I saw about dowsers. And that the New York Police Department used it to find a person that had gone missing and ended up in the bottom of Lake George. Anyway, so I was really impressed with this show and the fact that this guy could douse and find this person at the bottom of a lake. And I find out that this same guy is a president of the Dowsers Association in California. So he says, so I start telling him about the case. And I said, boy, I that would be fantastic, because we have the general area where this thing supposedly happened, and we'd like to go out there and do that. He says, well, I know of somebody that would really be useful for you. And so he says, we'll take a ride over the weekend and go see this guy. And so we did. Turned out to be an 80-year-old gentleman. And he had this Quonset hut that he had all his equipment in there. And we went upstairs in this Quonset. It was a very large one. And he had a big table, a drafting table, and it was loaded with pictures and business cards and everything. And there's a picture of him in a helicopter. And evidently he was working for oil companies, dowsing for oil. And so we told him about the case. We sit down with the map. He starts doing his thing, and he starts drawing where this thing is on the map. So long story short, I'm supposed to go out in a helicopter with him and this ex-Air Force guy that I thought was my friend. And that was the last thing I heard. He totally like disappeared. And I never heard a thing after that. So it wasn't a threatening situation, but it was a very disappointing situation, and one that I still to this day think that if they went out there and they discovered anything, they certainly didn't let me know. And that was big disappointment.
Wow. Now, one last question, because you triggered another memory of something. You had a long conversation with Lou Elizondo. Is he interested in experiencers? Is he interested in what your group is doing?
No, not really. He was very much focused on the nuts and bolts side of things. You know, I told him, you know, what I was doing and all that, but he really kind of stuck to the, and he also mentioned at the same time that they think they have it kind of figured out how these things operate. So I said, wow. All right. Very good.
Wow. Interesting. Okay. I'll let Nicole shut her down here.
Okay. Well, that's all I have for everybody tonight. And thank you so much, Les. This was such a wonderful talk. And I hope we can have you back on again in the future to discuss some of these finer points after your book and after Omega 4. That would be great.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate it very much, guys. Thank you, Grant and Nicole. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you guys.
Oh, yeah. This is great. Well,
wonderful. We could maybe have you on. We have experiencer panels where we've had quite a few where experiencers, we've had 60, 70 experiencers in, and everybody just gets to talk, say whatever they want. Maybe we can bring you in as sort of an expert where you may be able to advise people because they're all out there looking. We've had a number of these. We haven't had one for quite a while, Nicole. I don't think we've had one for a year, but we used to have them all the time.
The rabbit holes, I think. Yeah, maybe last June was the last rabbit hole, or October even. So it's been too long. We tried to have a couple, I think, but they fell through. So
I'll leave it up to you to schedule the next one. We'll do another one. Because these people just love it when they can. Yeah. They've never told the story before, and they can turn their cameras off. Nobody sees who they are. They can use whatever name they want, and they get to tell their story. So
that's good.
I appreciate what you're doing for people. I appreciate what you're doing. So thanks.
And I'll have links. I'll have all the links in the description when we post this to YouTube for opusnetwork.org and anywhere else folks can find you. So we'll get them all up. Thank you so much, Les.
Thank you so much, guys.
Beautiful.
Take care.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.